Accession number 27272, Mr. Malcolm Frost, Reel 3. Now, we're talking about your continuation training with the East Anglian Brigade Training Centre, which is at Blenheim Camp, Bury St Edmunds, November onwards, 51. You talked about the map reading exercise. You didn't do so well on that one.
No.
What about the tactical exercise? You know, things like how to advance, how to make an attack, how, even how
we did some small sort of what pepper pot attacking with small groups of platoon.
That's
where you break up into small numbers, and you've got with a pepper pot, you move up a bit at a time, but small groups at a time, gradually. So moving up, overtaking one another. We were taught to a bit of aircraft identification. We were taught how to take cover in the event of an air attack from aircraft. Those were sort of general tactics, but nothing military tactics about.
Nothing too serious.
No.
What about any defensive tactics? You know, this is. I mean, don't against it. I mean, about how to dig a trench, a slit trench.
Oh, we did. Certainly did a bit of sandbagging and trench digging. And in fact, at the end of the continuation training, we spent a fair bit of time out hockering at an ammunition dump. But filling sandbags, which weren't part of a training, it was just part of a chore prior to going abroad. I think one of my lasting memories of continuation training, might be a little bit off the track here, was the fact that King died during the time I was there. And I shall never forget the day that he died.
And why is that?
Well, I was going down, I was sent down to the orderly room for something which I can't remember. But I'd just arrived at the orderly room, and the orderly corporal came out and lowered the flag to half mast. And it happened at that time, the adjutant walked down and was about to go into the office. And he said to the corporal, "Corporal, what do you got the flag to half mast for?" And he said, "Sir, we've just heard the King has died." And the officer's retort was, "Don't be bloody stupid, man." And he said, "No, sir." He said, "It's true. The King died at Sandringham last night." And first time I saw an officer weep. He stood and he cried. And that has all stuck in my memory.
It seems a little over the top. Did it seem over the top to you at the time, or was it?
Well, I mean, we knew the King. People knew the King had been ill, but I don't think anybody. It came as a complete shock that he died, and I think everybody in the nation was shocked by the fact that he died. I mean, it wasn't expected, but he shed a tear, and he obviously felt that strongly about it.
Now, anything else about continuation training?
No, I nearly got picked for the funeral parade in London, but I wasn't quite smart enough, so I didn't mind that.
Were you playing any more football for the brigade?
I played soccer there while I was there. We didn't have a brigade team there, but just it was general soccer there, not anything in the way of competitive soccer. I did go for a WASB.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask. I mean, from your background and with your education, it's obvious that you are being head boy of a prestigious school. What about this question?
Well, I wasn't asked to go. I actually had to ask if I could go.
Now, why do you think that
was? I don't know why. I mean, when you went for your selection process for your national service, you were given various aptitude tests, and one of them was how to assemble a bicycle pump, that sort of thing. But I think I came out classified as what they termed OR, which was suitable for other rank training but not for officer training.
Now, why do you think that
happened? I don't know why, but I asked, and I was given a unit selection board, which really involved asking me what my parents did and whether they could support me if I became a second lieutenant. But they thought I was good enough to go down to Hampshire for a WASB, but I failed.
Now, why do you think you failed? What happened at the WASB?
You were treated as a cadet officer while you were there, and the NCOs had to call you sir, which I felt didn't always go down very well with them. You had to produce a lecture. You had to give a 3-minute talk on any subject. But the bulk of the time was spent tackling problems, problem solving it as a team. And you were given the role of a team leader, and it was up to you to do whatever, solve whatever problem you faced with.
What kind of problem?
They were all physical, virtually all physical problems, like getting a 50-gallon drum from A to B without touching the ground in between, and without without leaving any kit behind you used. And some of them, I thought they were impossible to do. But the one I had as a team leader was not that difficult. Obviously I didn't impress, and I failed.
Were you surprised to fail? I mean,
I was disappointed. I wasn't surprised. I didn't think I'd done terribly well, to be honest. So having failed was me.
Do you think it was more to do with your social background? I mean, because you come from a working class family.
I'm not being funny. I think that had an element, because I think your parents, you had to be supported during your period at Sandhurst, I believe. And I don't know whether my father could have supported me. But whether there was anything in there, I don't know. But I thought I'd performed most of the tasks reasonably well, but I somehow just didn't feel it had gone as well as it could have done.
So back to the unit.
So I went back to the unit and wasn't sorry that basically I was going with the draft that...
Anything else happened, you know, before you leave Bury St Edmunds?
No, I don't think so.
So when did you leave? How long were you there till?
February.
52.
Yeah.
So you were there about 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, the actual...
It would take a week.
The actual basic training is 10 weeks continuation training. As the actual period, but... I'm just looking for a spectacle. I can't find one.
Okay.
We actually drafted to Hong Kong on the 18th of March.
So where were you from February to March? Were you still,
there, but we were doing... We'd finished our continuation training, but as I'd said to you previously, we spent quite a bit of time going out to Hockering to the ammunition dump there, filling sandbags and putting a fortification around the Nissen huts that contained all the ammunition. But the actual draft was in...
Was that hard work? It sounds quite hard work.
Yeah, I went by lorry each morning from Bury and spent all day there. We had a packed lunch that we took with us from camp. And we did that for several days, if I remember rightly. It was quite hard work, yeah.
Now, any preparations for the draft? Either physical or mental, or what, you know, I mean, briefings?
No, you're given pre-embarkation leave, and...
Tell me about that. What did you do with that?
I can't remember long. I think it was 10 days, I think, if I remember rightly. Just spent some time with the family, played soccer for the local village.
Your parents worried? They knew where you were going by then.
Well, I knew I was going to Hong Kong. I didn't realise I was going to Korea, of course. Because, I mean, it wasn't... I was in the Royal Norfolk. So the Royal Norfolk were coming to the end of their term in Korea. We had no inkling that we were going to be transferred into Fusiliers, nor would my parents. So, I mean, they had no idea I was going to Korea. For them, it was just a question of going out the Far East to Hong Kong. No. So they weren't really concerned. I didn't seem to be particularly concerned about it.
And nor were you, I presume?
No.
Now, what about, embarkation leave, what about any other preparations? Any injections, vaccinations?
We'd had all the original inoculations during basic training. I don't remember taking any more.
Did they have any impact on you? I should have asked that at the time.
TAB was a bit rough. We had quite a few injections, which all listed in the passbook, in the paybook, weren't they? I didn't have any problems with them, really, to be honest. One lad did.
What happened to him?
Well, somebody, we lined up for our inoculations, and we were giving them, and they had then entered them in the book. Somehow he got confused, and somebody told him we got another one, which we did have, or going to have, I think, about 2 days later. And how he did it, nobody knew, but he joined the queue again, and he got a second dose, and he finished up in sick bay. He was a South African, from South African there. I don't quite know how he got joined up with us, a chap called Stridham. I don't know how that happened, but he did. He managed to get a double dose somehow.
Now, any other, what about kitting out with any foreign service?
We didn't get any different kit. We went out with our normal battle dress and our normal sort of denims and what have you.
Any briefings about what was to come?
Well, we briefed particularly on sexual diseases. That was basically it. I mean, we were going to a country in the Far East. We were told that we would be susceptible possibly to mosquitoes and possibly malaria, and we were advised that any medication we were given that we must take for that reason. We were warned off having any contact with ladies of ill repute, and then we were sort of sent on our way, basically, and that was it.
Now, what was the you went out in March. What was the voyage like?
It was a trip on the Mediterranean, largely, I enjoyed. We went out on the Danira, the troop ship Danira. It was... The weather, if I remember, was not too bad most of the way. It was the year, I think, if my memory served me correct, we were listening to the boat race, and I think it was the year that both of the crews managed to sink. So you could check that, 1952, my memory's correct. I think it's the year that both race crews sank. We didn't do very much on board.
What were conditions like? Because the Danira is an old troop ship. It's a new one.
I think it eventually became one of the educational boats, but had standees three high, canvas bunks, which were in the troop deck below, where they were three high. The meals were served on a cafeteria basis, and they had a most peculiar system because it was an Asiatic crew. It was SS India, I think, was the line. The cafeteria system, you were given a coloured plastic disc for your next meal. So you'd perhaps have a red round disc, and when you went for your meal, you handed that in, you'd be given perhaps a black square one. And so you always had a disc to take with you to have your meal. Well, that was fine until the week that I became seasick, when I was seasick for a week in the Indian Ocean. And when I eventually recovered and decided I should eat again, I had the wrong coloured disc because I hadn't had a meal for 4 or nearly 5 days. And I had great difficulty in getting a meal because he wouldn't give me one because I'd got the wrong coloured disc. It all sounds absolutely pathetic, really.
What was the food like? And
it wasn't too bad, actually. It was cafeteria style, one of these multi-compartment trays. It was the usual army-type food. I mean, it was all sort of English-type cooking with mashed potato and peas and the usual sort of bully beef and, as you say, corned beef and so on. It literally was normal sort of army style cooking. There was very little training that went on the boat. I mean, we did PE, obviously, to keep ourselves reasonably fit, but we had a lot of leisure time.
And what would you do with that?
Well, we just sat on the deck with my mates and played cards and sort of worked. Because, I mean, it was a 5-week cruise in those days.
Now, why did you suddenly get seasick? It's very unusual for someone to get seasick. I mean, that must be nearly a week or so into the voyage.
No, it was a lot more than a week. Yeah. I mean, we'd gone from Southampton to Jib to Portside. We were allowed off at Jib, we were allowed off at Portside. We went to Aden, where I must admit the expats treated us extremely well, took us into their homes and fed us and looked after us. We then went on to from Aden to Singapore, where I met my uncle, who was in the RAF, and spent an evening with him at the British Union Jack Club and Raffles Hotel.
Now, Why but the then, seasickness? Then?
Well, I don't know, because it was so rough in that particular part of the ocean. And coming back, believe it or not, and when we came back in September through the Med, I was seasick again because the Med was unbelievably rough.
So it's just.
So I'm not a good sailor.
It's when it's rough, you're seasick.
I've been on 6 cruises and I've been on seasick for a time on virtually all of them. So it was, yeah, I was violently seasick.
And anything else about the voyage then?
It was interesting, the ports of call we went to. And
Can you remember any getting ashore, any of the places?
Yeah, we in Cairo, sorry, port side, I was always intrigued by the bumboats, they call them, where they, you've probably been told about these before, but they have these little boats down, come around the side of the troop ship and they give you a basket to pull up their various wares if you want to purchase them, and fruit and all sorts of bits and pieces. We also had the galley man come on board, who was the magician who worked with day-old chicks. And he was I called him a galley man, because he was all saying, galley, 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 sorry, galley, 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 whatever that meant. Went ashore at Colombo, and found that an interesting sort of experience.
In what way?
Well, just the first real experience of what life was like abroad. There were still oxen carts in the streets. A type of world that I didn't really know existed. Singapore, we were there briefly, as I say, and we met my uncle. And then, of course, it was Hong Kong thereafter.
That's where you were going. And what happened when you got to Hong Kong? Well, that would be April, would it be?
We arrived on the 20th of April, yeah.
So it took me a month.
Yeah, 35 days. Remember only.
And what were your first impressions when you got to Hong Kong then?
The actual Hong Kong harbour, looking across the Victoria Peak, it was very impressive. But we weren't there very long because we were immediately shipped up into the new territories by train to a place called Fanling Crossroads.
Fanling?
Yeah.
All one word.
Yeah, attached to the 1st Battalion Middlesex Regiment, who had been in Korea but had come out and were now based in the territories, Kowloon and New Territories.
So you were sent to 1st Battalion Middlesex Regiment at Fanling.
We became D Company of the Middlesex Regiment, the drafted, basically.
The whole draft, they didn't split you up?
No, we became D Company.
And how did... there was a camp at Fanling Crossroads,
yeah, yeah, Nissen Huts, yeah.
Now, how did you settle in? I mean, what happened when you got there? Do you know what I mean? Because coming in and forming a new company,
yeah,
Italian rather.
Well, we found that I know it's a sad thing to say, but we found we were treated really quite badly. Because we weren't part of the regiment, we were attached to the regiment. We found over the period that we were there that we were, more often than not, we were duty company. We were doing a lot of the guards, a lot of the picker duty. We were doing that as well as training. I mean, I had 2 stints. One stint during the period we were there doing border patrol up on the New Territories Chinese border, where we had an OP spend a week with binoculars sitting there writing down every activity that took place on the other side of the border. And there was also an enormous ammunition dump at a place called Bird's Pass, and that had to be guarded.
We need to deal with both of them. What happened first, though, when you first joined them? I will come back to this, don't worry. When you first got there, you made it to D Company. What happened? What were you put?
We were put into Nissen Hut billets. And just introduced to the camp.
Now, why didn't you join the Norfolks? Where were they?
Because they were in Korea, but we weren't old enough because you weren't allowed to go into Korea until you're 19. I mean, that was the government that set that limit.
And the whole draft.
We were all underage. I mean, well, we weren't, not all of us, because there were handful of regulars with us as well had rejoined. I mean, there was at least three or four who were a bit older, but they stayed with us at the Middlesex Regiment. They didn't go off to the Norfolk Regiment.
So they were still the Norfolks. The first
still in Korea.
Were still in Korea.
Still in Korea. Yeah.
So now what sort of happened? You know, during the first period at Fanling Crossroads, what were you doing?
We were doing fitness training because we'd come off the boat. We did a lot of route marshes. We were laying barbed wire fortification to areas where the practical work it was. I mean, it was not training as such, but we actually were doing a lot of barbed wire laying.
Now tell us about that. Where, what were you doing?
Up on the hillside places where they were sort of fortifying them, for why we don't know. But that was largely it. We had a lot of...
How did you go about it? I mean, because barbed wire is not the easiest thing.
Well, it was all the enormous rolls, and we were given sort of heavy-duty gloves, and it was a question of driving metal stakes into the hillside and rolling out these rolls of barbed wire. You pulled them out in a roll, they would stay in a roll, and then you had another roll beside it, and if I remember rightly, we put a third roll on the top, so it was like a triangular formation of three rolls of barbed wire.
And with the stake?
With stake through the middle to hold the three together.
And was it just one, you just do one
long mass of wiring, yeah. I believed it was for practical purposes. I think it was trying.
But you weren't digging any trenches or anything to go with it. Just putting the barbed wire.
Yeah, yeah.
And what else were you doing? What's the next thing? How are you taking to the climate?
I found it quite hot. One little experience. I had what's called a varicocele, which was a extension of the testicle, and it got quite. It wasn't that painful, but it got uncomfortable. So I eventually decided I really ought to report sick. And if you report sick in the army, you had to go with your small pack, with your housewife and all the bits and pieces in, and you probably wear. And I reported sick on the morning it happened that they were doing a 5-mile run that day. Well, the sick parade was the most extensive sick parade there'd been for days, apparently. There was a large number of people on the sick parade. I was sent down to Kowloon to the 33rd General Hospital to find out what the problem was. And I saw a specialist, and I was sent back to camp fit for duty, which I was. But unbeknown to me, that day the NCO, I don't know what the sergeant, what he was, had said that anybody who was on sick parade who came back fit to report for duties, in other words, had been skiving, was going to have to do this run anyway. And I found myself doing this run in the heat, midday heat, which was absolutely crippling. And I felt that very unfair, that I had a genuine reason to be sick but got lumbered with all the others.
Did they ever sort it out for you then?
I was given a special sort of jockstrap to wear, and that helped cure the problem. It became okay eventually.
Now, what's the next thing that happens there? There's these two things you were sent on. One, the border.
Yeah.
Which comes first? Is that the next thing we move on to?
No, the border patrol was a small group of us were sent up to an OP observation post, which was immediately above the Chinese border, and you actually took a shift where you sat with a pair of binoculars sort of viewing the countryside out in front of you. I mean, it was largely paddy fields, to be honest, but you had to actually record every sort of activity that you saw. If there were two peasants came into the paddy field bearing buckets of manure or something, you had to actually record it. So we had a week up there to do that. That was not bad because you got away from the normal sort of camp discipline, and you could get away without shaving, for instance, if you. So, because we were running under a corporal up there, so
what
that
was the
was
OP like? I mean, was it a?
It was a you were tented, and it was just a. It's difficult to describe. It's more like a hide, basically, and that sort of thing you would think of, you know, a bird hide. Actually, on the hillside, we sat inside it, and you looked out through a slit, sort of viewing the countryside around, and noting every hint of activity that went on in front of you.
And through binoculars.
Yep. Yeah.
And was there ever any point to what you were writing down?
Well, I never saw anything of any significance because there was no sort of military activity going on. There didn't appear to be any military activity going on in front where we were. I mean, it literally was seemed to be sort of agricultural activity, and that was it, basically. But perhaps when some people went there might have been some activity that was important. I don't know.
And you take it in turns on duty?
You took a shift on duty, and you then had to record everything while you were there.
And what happened to the record you made? I mean, was it?
Don't ask me, because I don't know. It was taken. We came down with it, and it was handed over. And
so you didn't wireless it in?
No.
So it
was
urgent. I mean,
no, not as far as I know. I don't remember. We were in radio contact with the camp, but I don't remember everything being sort of wirelessed in. I think it was just taken back in document form.
And that was one thing you did. And
yeah. The other was guarding the ammunition dump, which was a place called Bird's Pass. And you had a week there with two NCOs, two corporals, and enough of you to cover 24-hour guard duty.
And what was that like?
It was easy. The only thing was that one night, the orderly officer and the orderly sergeant decided they would come and investigate to see whether the place was being properly guarded. And this is another experience I remember extremely well. I was on... I'd